January 26th. This is Bible in the Ancient Near East. And the thesis of this course is that there is much information that we can glean outside the Bible when we know about what's going on in the rest of the world at the time the Bible is given, at the time the Bible is preached, that can help us shed light on elements of the Tanakh. Okay, it's a simple thesis. There's a week of this in my introduction to Bible courses. Take it for granted that not everything that needs to be known in the ancient world is actually written in the Torah. Maybe there's something we can learn from Hittite land sale laws, which we know about, that can help us understand Parshas Chayei Sarah and how Abraham purchases a plot of land for Sarah. Maybe we can learn something from Sumerian rules about what to do if you have no children, how and your wife wants to have a child in the house. We can learn something from that practice, perhaps, that can shed light on the way Sarah behaves in Parshas Lech Lecha and Parshas Vayera. Does this mean that before we came to this information, and much more like it, that we didn't really fully understand these stories in the Torah? It's hard to say that. This information that was practically all of what we're going to be studying in this course was not really available to Rashi, nor to the Vilna Gaon. Although I must say the Rambam and the Mor Nebuchim does indicate either awareness of some of this material or a suspicion of some of this material. That certain mitzvahs of the Torah react to certain behaviors of the ancient Near Eastern idolaters, and we're reacting to it in certain ways. This does not only appear in the Mor Nebuchim, this appears in the Mishnah Torah. Right? The Rambam explains certain chukim in light of ancient Near Eastern practices. Right? Ramban is often critical of those. We'll test both of them. We'll see how that fits the information. Okay. What I'll do mostly is place the information before you, and you can decide. Right. Okay, so on the syllabus, we start simple. We start with languages and alphabets. You can see certain languages that can be very helpful to Hebrew. Since Moab is the closest landmass to Israel proper, the last place we stopped off on the way to getting into Sefer Yehoshua, right? That's where Moshe dies. So it stands to reason that Moabite, a Semitic language, right? Moab is basically the grandnephew of Abraham, right? It's his nephew's son. So Moab might help us, if we can get our hands on some Moabite, maybe that'll help us with some Hebrew. Okay? These are two other languages maybe you're not familiar with, Ugaritic and Akkadian. Ugaritic is a language spoken to the north of Israel, also very close geographically to Israel, and therefore it's also Semitic and will help us with some certain difficult Hebrew words. But especially Akkadian, Akkad is a nation mentioned in the Torah, Parshas Noach. And about 10 years ago, a professor in this university, his name is Professor Tawil. Is there a relative of his in this class? I read the name Tawil before. Is he here?
Jesse Tawil.
Yeah. Anyway, Michael Tawil. So he made a lexicon of all Akkadian words that appear to us through various archaeological formats. Thousands and thousands of words. Right? And he conjugates them, and he works. I helped him work on it. I did letter chof. Different people helped him with different letters. I helped him with all the Akkadian words that begin with the letter chof. And I'll bring all this in the coming days. I couldn't drive to school today, so I left my whole suitcase at home. But so I'll show you this. And he has a tremendous amount of help from Akkadian to Hebrew. The reason for that is because simply a lot more Akkadian has been found than Moabite. Right? As far as the Moabite language, a very significant find about 150 years ago, but that's about all we have. We have hardly any Moabite material that has survived for us. One of the most famous archaeological finds of all time, known as the Mesha Stone. It's so famous, I deal with it separately towards the end of this course. I mean, you see it on the back of the this syllabus. And it helps us debunk certain theories that appear in Moabite stories, especially Megillas Rus. Megillas Rus has a big Moabite connection, and there are some commentaries that make draw interesting theories based on the really Rus is has awful grammatical inconsistencies. Really, especially between masculine and feminine. And there are those who try to explain that in light of Moabite influences. And we'll see whether that those influences are correct or not. Okay, I make reference to Chaim Tawil's work. It says, an Akkadian lexical companion for biblical Hebrew. Right, just with the preface is in these pages. Yeah, if you have your computer here, you can pick it up right now. And especially be helpful is two below that is Brown, Driver, and Briggs, A Hebrew and English Lexicon to the Old Testament. This was a book written in 1905, but there still hasn't been anything like it. This takes not just Akkadian like Tawil does, it takes all ancient languages and shows us the connection that it has to biblical Hebrew. It takes every shorish that appears in the entire, it's not a very thick book, every shorish and name and city and place and name of gods, everything, every Aramaic, every Hebrew, and it shows you how that word is used in the ancient world. Amazing work. These three are not Jews. They're three Gentiles. And they did an amazing work over 100 years ago that still hasn't been matched. Right? So we'll be using that. The book between these two is a fanciful work with about 200 examples of phrases in Tanakh that are, on the face of it, somewhat difficult, and he uses ancient languages to make a chiddush out of the phrase. Okay, I'll just give an example that comes up the top of my head. Is a few times in Tanakh, it sounds very quite vulgar, where someone says, "I sort of like trash talk. I'm going to destroy everyone in this town, down to the last mashtin bekir." Right, David uses that phrase to Abigail, talking to a woman, for goodness sakes. How do you use that terminology? What's a mashtin bekir? Right. So in Melachim Aleph it's used twice. It's used about five times in the whole Tanakh. Right. So if you look in an English translation, you'll see either that it's idiomatic, because you have to explain what the words mean. Kir is a wall. Right? Mashtin. That's the Gemara's language for urination. Right? I'm going to kill everybody that urinates against the wall. Right? So most English translations translate that as an idiom, meaning a dog. Dog lifts his leg and urinates on the wall. Right? If you would take, let's say, traditional press, Tansino, Jewish Publication Society, take a lot of different English translations, you'll see about four or five different interpretations of this. Right, the Koran has that those who pisseth against the wall. So, all right, but that's the way you talk to a woman, you know. So, this book takes this terminology and tries to show through Aramaic and perhaps Arabic also that Mashtin Bekir means a resident of the city, like Kiryat Arba, Kiryat Sefer. Right. He wants to say Mashtin Bekir means a resident of the city. Right? Resident of this neighborhood. Okay. Alright, this is all very fanciful. If you're going to say what's the nafka meaning here, I think for Roman numeral 1, it's worthy in and of itself to be able to come to what is the intention of the author in terms of what was originally meant by the phraseology. Okay? When you talk about idioms, you know, you have to know the culture to know the idiom. There are whole huge books that try to explain why someone would say break a leg to an actor before they go on stage, or what it means to be in the limelight. Why are we saying those kind of things? What does it mean to have bones in the closet? Right? So where do these phrases, where do they stem from? And so you have to go back to the first time it's used. There's a lot of scholarship involved in these kind of things, right? So, When you see, let's say, a prophet like Hosea who speaks about people who are committing adultery, and he says, "You commit adultery like a baker." It's a Baker commit better adultery than most other people? Right? So what can you right away, does it come if you say Hebrew is your first language? Why would you say you're committing adultery like a baker? Because how do you say a baker? In Hebrew. No fed. How do you say adultery? Ni'uf. Yeah. Sinaf, right? Ni'uf. So the words sound alike. So, okay. They use the Hebrew word. You commit adultery like an, adulterer. I don't know. Okay, but the word adultery comes from the word for adult. But be that as it may, but it goes beyond that. That would be just, okay, that's fanciful. That's what someone who fancies himself an expert in Semitics. That's not enough. A baker wakes up very early in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, to bake his bread. His day is from 3 o'clock till 10 o'clock. After people have had breakfast, they've bought their food for the day, he's off for the day. All the men are out in the field. A baker commits adultery better than anyone else. He's off from work when all the men are out, and he knows which women are, right? So then Mefarshim explained that's what O'Shea was talking about. But if we're not exposed to bakers and how they work, we're not going to know what he meant. All right? Look, you can raise your hand now and say, who are we to tell what O'Shea actually meant? I don't have O'Shea in front of me. Okay, look, that's my, what can I do? People do that with Shakespeare also. They make a whole old Simmons out of Hamlet. And sometimes if Shakespeare's sitting there, he said, I never meant that, I never talked about that. Right? So when it comes to the biblical text, you say Shivim Panim LaTorah. I like to give you, you're adults and you're thinking people. Just as long as you're doing it L'shem Shamayim, right? Your attention of what you're taking out and extracting out of the pasuk. It's a job of a good teacher to tell you what's good extraction and what's bad extraction, right? Because it's just not grammar. It's not grammatically correct. I mean, look, sometimes there's good Torah, and there's Shal Shabbos Torah, and there's Chassidish Torah, there's, you know. but I'll say it like this, that the Tanakh is written in such a flowery way, such an extraneous way. The first word in the Torah, Rashi wanted to make the point. Because I don't want to put you on the spot, but Bereishis does not mean in the beginning. That's Barishona. Bereishis means in the beginning of. Rashi's very first comment to the Torah wonders. Well, not very first. The first one he makes is a very Zionist kind of statement about our rights to the land of Israel. But when he starts talking about why the word is Bereishis, he wants to let you know the Bible uses words purposely, and I'm not going to be afraid to give you a drash to explain why this word was used and not another word. But I digress. So we start with language alphabets. We will discuss the fact that the Hebrew language has evolved over time quite a bit. The Hebrew alphabet, I should say. The language has not evolved so much over time, and that's a thing of great beauty. Right? You've probably sometime in high school read a little bit of Beowulf or Canterbury Tales. Right? Look how much English has evolved in 1,000 years, and English has been used all that time. Right? Look from Shakespeare to today, how much English has evolved. You can't get through much of Shakespeare without some explanations at the bottom. Right? And that's just a few hundred years. But I submit to you that if someone has the full total knowledge of Tanakh, they can move to Israel and buy food in a grocery store. They can figure it out. Maybe there's some words they don't know, some technology, some, you know. But they'll figure it out. Or vice versa. Someone who is a linguist in Israel today but never opened the Tanakh, they can open the Tanakh and make their way through. They can know what Shorash Yomar's conjugation is. It's amazing how little the Hebrew language has evolved. Language itself, in terms of a language, that's a tribute to the fact that we've always been teaching our young children, we've always been working with them, we've always been literate, we've always been, at 6 years old, Chamisha Mikra, at 6, we were sitting in a classroom, and we've always been doing this. Okay. So this is so much for idioms, phrases. I'm going to give some examples if I make it through this syllabus this morning. Okay, now you can see 2 and 3 are dedicated to specific narratives in Bereishis and Shmos. Okay? You see creation epics, deluge stories, migration stories. It's a lot of people moving around a lot in Bereishis. Barren matriarchs, sibling rivalries. These are trends. Sefer Bereishis that we'll see, will mirror a lot of other stories that appear in the ancient world. All of these materials are in your in the Chuvaret, with the exception of Damrash. You see D. Damrash, narrative cognament. I didn't put that whole thing in. I just put a little bit of it in to give you a very interesting contrast between, you probably know about this already, the flood story in the Torah and other ancient flood stories that appear in Asia. You're all familiar with this, right? Each one has there's always a Noah character, and there's someone who saved the world. And we'll see that there's one, there's two things that separate the Torah story from all the others. Okay? A certain component. Okay? So that is, so Damrash, that's all I have there for him, just about the connection to the, to Noah. Okay, and then Exodus narratives. Okay, this is just until the, before we get to Halacha in Shmos. I'm just doing narratives. Right, so you see we're talking about slavery, 10 plagues, redemption. Right. Okay. Most practically everything in this list is from a scholarly standpoint, but there's one thing. It says J.D. Long, The Riddle of the Exodus. I wouldn't say that this is on the same level as the other books, but it's a very interesting suggestion of what the 10 plagues were. James Kugel, The Bible as It Was. Page. And there are two chapters in that relate to us that we're going to be seeing. Chapter 17 and chapter 18. And then we move to some very interesting stuff. Law and Custom. Okay. You see the first book is Moshe Greenberg, History of the Israelite Religion. Just made that a capital line there. That is a great compendium in English of a six-volume work called Toldot Emunat Yisrael by a man named Yechezkel Kaufman. That book was written 50, 60 years ago. And it's basically, it compares the Torah to over 100 ancient religions and civilizations. It's an amazing, amazing work. The Chumash Leibowitz cites him pretty well. Right? I caution you I should have cautioned you before. Some of what appears here is not traditional. Right? When I say non-traditional, we'll learn over time what that means. Our tradition is, especially I should point to you with Parshas Yisro, that there was a specific time in history where God revealed His will to us, and that will is the Torah, and that we have that Torah in our hands today. It's a very important tenet of faith of the Rambam. All right? The Torah is not the product of five different authors over about 1,000 years, which is what Moshe Greenberg here takes for granted. All right? I also caution you that the origin of that opinion, which starts to surface already in the end of the 18th century, the origins of these opinions, of multiple authors of the Torah, really originates in anti-Semitism. Right? The origins of these opinions, especially Julius Wellhausen, and Paul Gamana to the Old Testament, these people were using their positions about the authorship of the Torah to show that Judaism is practically maybe 50 to 100 years older than Christianity. Of course, this is well before archaeology and well before any information we'll be learning in this course. Right? So that Judaism is a big hoax. It's all even Ezra's a hoax. It's all, right? Dead Sea Scrolls and everything else have proved that Wellhausen was a hoax. But his work was widely studied and picked up by scholars, but that doesn't—that's not here nor there about we're students of faith. If you can ask me, how can I prove that Ma'amad Har Sinai happened? I would say that Ma'amad Har Sinai is a little different significantly different than major important events in faith events in other religions, which tend to take place in very small groups. Right, and what's most one of the most important events in Christianity is maybe the crucifixion, or probably the resurrection is even more important for them. It's not something that happens in front of a large group of people, right? Or in Islam, Muhammad's rise to the heavens from the distant mosque at the very end of the Quran, he does so alone. He dropped down a petek for people to know about. All right? And for us, our important events are only the ones that take place in front of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people, according to the event. You say, well, that whole thing is a hoax. Someone just gathered and said, let's all make believe that 1,000 years ago this happened to 600,000. Who's gonna go along with that? Why did it take until 1840 for some Reformed Jews to say that the Torah doesn't exist? It was fabricated. Right? I'll tell you this: the proof I need is that my father told me that there's Yetzias Mitzrayim. I remember my earliest days as a Seder. My father told me that we left Egypt. And how did he know? An unbroken chain from those who left Egypt. And his father bet. So I'm not looking for proof. I'm looking for evidence. Okay? Heck, I can't even prove to you that I'm sitting here talking to you. All right? And I'm not being coy. All right? To prove that I'm looking to prove these things. All right? That's very clear. And let's go further. So we have Law and Custom, that's Moshe Greenberg. And then the next one is a book by Shalom Paul. Now, I'll admit that I just taught a course called God and Man this last semester. Are you in that? Who's in it? No? Anybody in that class? No? So, and that book used this, that course used this book. So, I'm not going to take up so much time in this course, but this book by Shalom Paul, it's called Studies in the Book of the Covenant in Light of Cuneiform Law. It's the whole book is a comparison between Parshas Mishpatim and the laws of the ancient world that are parallel.
Professor Eichner is teaching a course on that.
Oh, I'm sorry, someone?
Professor Eichner is teaching
a course. In the Westbrook?
No, in the YC.
Okay. So I took a course like that with him 30 years ago.
All right, do we read these in class or do we read these at home?
Well, it's in your Choveret, so, I will, assign. These are the pages that appear in the Choveret. I'm not going to say that every one of these pages is what we're going to be doing, or what you're going to be doing, but this is what I hope to cover over the semester. Okay? And, again, you need a full Tanakh for the class. All right? Let me just introduce you to the difference between apodictic and casuistic law, because both appear in the Torah, but only one basically appears in cuneiform law. I mean, but cuneiform law is law that appears in cuneiform, and it's Sumerian law codes as opposed to Sumerian tales or legends of their great ancient heroes. With that, let me just, before I get into apodictic and casuistic, I'm going to give you three Akkadian words on the board, which is what the people who write these ancient stories that we have found actually call them. The three words are dinu, kapsu, shakru. These are, they almost look Hebrew or Aramaic. And dinu are dinim. The Code of Hammurabi is dinu. The Egyptians, Sumerians, Babylonians, they had their own ancient codes. Shalom Paul deals with about three or four altogether. Okay. Stands to reason that the ancients also had to deal with oxen that gore, or people in big pits in the public square where someone falls and someone that lights a fire that spreads. You can see Baba Kamba and see Baba Basra is all over the ancient world. Right? And chances are, if you wanted to understand a deeper meaning of what Chazal even considered Yeshiva Shein Ve'Ivra. What did they learn there, for goodness sakes? Dinim. Right? Okay, there's lots to learn there. Okay. Right, if there was such a place where they taught in the ancient world, where they taught things in the Vayishmor Mishmati, Mitzvosai, Chukosai, so what are those things? Right? So that's mostly what okay. We'll see trends that emerge from the way that an Egyptian or a Sumerian views din and the way the Torah views din. Right? It's a very different purpose behind Code of Hammurabi's law and the Torah's law. Right? In a nutshell, the Code of Hammurabi wants to have an orderly society so that we can worship our God and gain His protection and strength and right? And that God is through me. Hammurabi thought of himself as a God, as an embodiment of the main God. And that to keep these laws will be more of a smart idea. Law-abiding society is a successful society. Okay? So, what the Torah wants would appear through our sources and our philosophers is a moral individual. We want to create upright individuals who will bound in the fact that they are in God's image. Okay. All right. So, this is, for instance, why in almost every ancient law code, there's hardly any exception in the whole ancient Near East. If you commit murder, you can buy yourself off. And so there's hardly any place that automatically kills someone who is admits he totally committed the murder. Right? He admits that he did so. As opposed to the Torah, which is very, very careful all over the place, in Devarim, at the end of Bamidbar, in Vayikra, is that if someone commits murder, there's no kofar lenefesh. Right? Okay, if there's a technicality for, according to the law, that he gets off because the witnesses didn't see it, or whatever, okay, make a doubt that way. But once it's been proven and shown that this person committed murder, there's no avoiding the punishment. Right? There's a number of additional differences that Sean Paul points out, where the Torah stands mamash alone, and 20 ancient codes have a different approach to this particular thing. Right. The Torah is the only ancient code that has a death penalty for kidnapping. Most you must. So no ancient code that has such a draconian punishment. Nor for beating parents. There's some very creative punishments in the ancient world for beating parents. But none that has so draconian as the death penalty for doing so. Like the Torah has in Parshas Mishpat. Right, so that's dinim. Kapsu are stories of what we would call rituals. Not stories, but they're ritual observances. What do you do if it hasn't been raining for the whole entire season? What kind of feathers should you wear? What kind of virgins should you slaughter? What kind of babies should you give up to the god? Those are kapsu, right? Okay, and shapru are stories of ancient heroes. The origins of the universe are very... You can't believe what appears in Bereishis Bara Elokim, as Ishmael Mizoritz, is so dull and boring compared to what you find in Sumerian and Egyptian accounts of the creation of the world. And you see some of those accounts actually make their way into some of our Midrashim. Right? Okay, there's a great fight between two gods. One looks like a fish, one looks like a bull. And there's a long description about how they're fighting. And one, the fish bites off the ear of the bull and spits it across the cosmos. And the blood that spurts out becomes the planets. And the piece of the ear becomes the sun. And this is really creative. how did we get here? What is it all about? How did that yellow thing get out there? And why does it get blackened in the middle of the sky, we heard 100 years ago? And why does the moon disappear in front of us once every 2 years or so? What causes those things? And what makes the lightning and the thunder what are those things up there? Right? So, led to a lot of superstitions. And they have these stories of ancient heroes. What's a very interesting thing also is that in... across the board, the lifespans of those ancient heroes are 72,000 years, 147,000 years. I mean, our lifespans in Bereishis are nothing compared to what you see in some of these stories here. Right? Okay. All right. So there's something very interesting that Moshe Greenberg points out, is that we have still not found. Right, negative evidence, but we've still not found in all the 200 years or so of the science of archaeology, we've still not found one ancient document that contains any two of these together in the same document. The Code of Hammurabi is not going to have any kapsu in it. It's not going to have any rituals. That's just law. It's Baba Kama. It's Parshas Mishpatim. Right? Following? And certainly the chakra stories, they're not going to be anything about Dinim in those things. They may have, you know, no one's studying ancient Akkadian texts anymore for Midas Tovos, right? We're going to say you should pay Bikacholim because Hashem paid Bikacholim in Tarshish Vayera. You should be a good host because Avraham brings in guests. So we're learning also on Hagos Tovos from our Shabru text, which is Sefer Bereishis. But no one's studying those texts anymore. To even well, the Chinese maybe study Confucius. I don't know, but no one studies stories like these for Hagos Tovos. First of all, we're going to see some of them. Those stories are, there's no morality in them to begin with. The ancients were not considered them, did not consider themselves to be law abiding so that they could be moral. They didn't care about morality. All they cared about was to get the rain they needed for the crops to grow, to have security against another nation that might threaten us. And the best way to get that is to serve the God that can assure those things for us, right? And serve him the way our high priest says we should. Right? They've been doing it for hundreds of years, maybe. I know that means I have to give up my firstborn child, but okay, that's a small price to pay for the security. Right? And if I lose the next battle, it's because the God of the nation that defeated us is stronger than ours right now, and probably I should worship that God now. Right? The people were not interested in morality because, Chevra, when you look at the description of the gods themselves that these people had, the gods were far from moral. Not even, you know, the Roman gods weren't moral. Surely 1,000 years earlier, these gods were not moral. They fought each other. They stole from each other. They occasionally came down to earth for a particularly beautiful, mortal once in a while and took them. Look, these things don't exist. I'm just saying what they wrote about what they felt their gods were, right? Were doing. Right? You know what I'm saying? Well, for instance, the chief god of Canaan was called Baal Hamod, the god who covets and takes. So for a good Canaanite or a Sidonite, Sidon is the Canaanite offshoot, to covet something and not take it if you're in a position of power, is you're not acting godly. Right? So there's a story in Tanakh like this. What am I talking about? Who was married to a Sidonite woman who coveted something from another person in his kingdom? Ahav. He wanted a vineyard. His wife is Izebel, the Sidonite princess. And he's depressed because his subject isn't giving him the vineyard. Right? So his wife says, "You call yourself a king? That's not how where I come from. If your subject doesn't want to give you something, you take it." She was just behaving like a good Sidonite. Right? And of all of Ahav's excesses, this is such a great morality play in the Bible. Of all of Ahav's terrible excesses in his book, Zorah, what takes down his kingdom? When does Eliyahu come to him and say, "You lost your kingdom"? Remember the famous quote, "Haratzachta"? No? "Vigam Yorashta"? Have you killed and then you inherited his vineyard also? So that takes down this wicked, wicked, horrible, awful king who does so many terrible things. Murder, Abodazar, everything. Gilearios, the whole works. But what takes down his kingdom? He takes someone's subject's vineyard. Because he behaved like a Tzilunite. No bigger chil Hashem than that. Okay? So at what point does Greenberg make is that the Torah contains all three of these. Right? Go ahead, tell me which Torah. The Dinu was largely Shmos and Dvarim, right? Some of Bamidbar. What's the Kapsu? Rituals, mostly. Are you getting there? Vayikra. Shachar is certainly voracious. Part of Shmos, the beginning of Shmos. Quite a bit of Bamidbar, right? What'd you say? A little Dinim in Bamidbar, too. Towards the end, yeah. Okay. Beginning of Bamidbar has some Kapsu. There's Nazir, Sota, that's certainly a ritual. Right? In ritual storyline, right? Okay. So we haven't found any one document from the ancient world that contains any two of these in the same document. But our Torah has all three of them. then, now let me explain to you the difference between apodictic and casuistic law. Because practically all of ancient law, all of the dinu you're going to find, is what we call casuistic in nature. I know these are fancy words, but you'll get the point immediately. Casuistic is what the beginning of Mishpatim is. It reacts to situations. Right? If you dig a pit and someone falls in, then this is what you have to pay. And now let's look up. This also, I must immediately digress to say that obviously we haven't developed Akkadian, Sumerian, Egyptian, Babylonian law to the extent that we've developed the Torah, because no one's studying those things anymore. But we have something called Torah Shebaal Peh. Right? We have a huge development of the Torah through what ended up being written down as the Talmud and the Sepharim and the Gaonim and the Rishonim and the Codes and the Achronim. Right? So we have we must say I can't tell what to actually do in practice from the pasuk in the Torah that talks about falling in a pit until I learn the Torah Shebaal Peh. Right? There's a whole group of Jews over time that have sorely disagreed with this. They're known as Karaites or Tzedukim. Right? That say, no, everything I need to know about setting up a society is right there in Parshas Mishpatim alone. Not only do I not need to supplement that with any other information, I am not allowed to, because Torah is Hashem Tamima. That's their creed. Torah is Hashem Tamima. The Torah is full in itself. They loved that pasuk so much that the Karaites said it Shabbos afternoon as chapter 19 of Tehillim and chapter 119 of Tehillim, which is this huge chapter that speaks of the fullness of Torah. 176 pasukim. Every single one of them talks about the vast greatness of Torah. You don't need the Torah Shabbat. Everything is in the Torah itself. This course, obviously. We'll prove over time is that the Torah itself feels that there is an oral tradition that helps guide what's written there, because there are lots of places where the Torah says do this like I told you, and that pasuk is nowhere. Hashem tells Moshe, slaughter the animal the way I told you. Where does it say? There's no description of shechita in the Torah, and there's no pasuk that ever says to shecht chulin. It only says to Shech Kachin. Maybe Chulin, you could just choke the animal and eat it. Right? So there's this Torah Shebaal Peh. Right? We wouldn't recognize Shabbos or Kashrus, and you wouldn't recognize Karaite observance either. And by the way, where are they? I mean, you know, it shows that without the Torah Shebaal Peh, you're going to fall away. Okay? I mean, Karaite observance their Shabbos is crazy. They sit in the dark, they don't leave the house. No fire, no heat, no light. Because it says, Lo tzavar reish b'chol moshav seichem b'yom HaShabbos. Which the Gemara Shabbos takes to mean, don't light a fire on Shabbos, but you can light a fire right before Shabbos and keep it lit. You can have food warmed up and kept on fire from before. Right? When
so they eat cold food also, they go.
No. When the Ethiopians came to Israel in the early 90s, very famous stories, they were taken to Shaare Tzedek, some of them were sick. When they saw hot, heated food, they were very, very observant. They were very, they were very, very religious. When they saw heated food, they went crazy. They thought, they don't keep kosher here. They were given hot food on Shabbos. They thought there was Mechil Shabbos. Shaare Tzedek is a very, very, very firm-run hospital. And they had food that was, warmed up appropriately, as you all know. And they thought that they were getting unkosher food because the food was warm on Shabbos. Because they didn't have Torah Shebaal Peh all those years there. Right? And it's interesting is that just for the digression about how important it is to have Torah Shebaal Peh, is that there is a pasuk in Parshas Kisisa. It says Sheishes Yomim Ta'avod Uvayom Hashvi'i Tishlos. Then it says afterwards Bechorish Uvakatsir Tishlos. There's a problem with this line. Because I've already been told earlier in the Torah not to do malacha on Shabbos. Why would I think to tell separately, don't plow and harvest. Isn't that malacha? Why are you treating these two separately? There are 39 malachas. Where does it say in the Torah not to write on Shabbos? Where does it say in the Torah not to weave on Shabbos? Why are you picking out these two? All right. So the general rabbinic, meaning the answer you get in the Gemara, is that this pasuk isn't talking about Shabbos. It's talking about Shemitah. Right?
6 days.
6 days. And sometimes in the Torah, where Yomim refers to years, and that this is a law of Shemitah. The Torah never says not to Chorish the year before Shemitah. Okay? So here it tells you that. Okay, there's a famous machlokes Rabbi Shmuel, Rabbi Kiva, and Yerushalmi, and a few places in the Bible. Of course, the Karaites are not going to go there. But look what the Karaites do with this pasuk. Now, the Karaites actually have Shulchan Aruch, their own law codes. And some of what they do in their law codes, I studied Karaite law for a whole year here in graduate school years ago. And it's just amazing. I mean, I like to use the information I gleaned from that course in order to do what I'm about to do. Is to show that what they end up doing is I think even a bigger stretch. Okay? So they keep it Shabbos. Yes, definitely Shabbos. But this is not plowing and harvesting. No. They show through a story in Sefer Shoftim that when Shimshon gave a riddle to the Philistines, remember the story? If you don't get it, I have to give, you give me 30 garments of clothing. If you do get it, then I... So how did they get the answer? No one in this class knows how they got the answer. What? Say it. His wife. I married a Philistine woman, and they cajoled her into giving the answer. All right. So his Philistine wife, Shimshon thought, oh, I can assimilate with the Philistines, they'll start to love me. No. His wife tricked him, his wife gave in, and she told the answer. So when he gave over the 30 garments, he said, Lu charashtem be'eglosi, lo yedatem chidosi. If you had not plowed my calf, you never would have gotten the answer. So first of all, the Karaites insist that that means they raped her. All right? And then Charisha here means that you can't have marital relations on Shabbos. And not only that, you can't give birth on Shabbos. They're very, very strict with Shabbos. Right? No marital relations on Shabbos. No Charisha on Shabbos, no Katsira on Shabbos. If a woman has to give birth on Shabbos, let her try to hold it in until after Shabbos is over. Is that crazy? They have to sit in the dark, they can't leave the house, no hot food, no light, and they took away just about the only thing to do in the house. Anyway, so now you see why there's no carrots.
Yeah.
That's their law.
Is it practiced though, or is it just like...
I don't know if they're from Karaites today. There are lots of Jewish laws and Shabbos that aren't practiced by Jews either. There's hardly any Karaites left. There's a small community in Staten Island. There is a World Karaite Center in the Old City. I don't know. But there's a scholar named Naftali Weider who claims that the Karaites did not originate with Anan ben David. I don't know if you know the history of it, where they started in the Gaonic times, but that they're actually just the continuation of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Tzedukim, Tusim, Karaites. It's just one strand. That's an interesting theory. In other words, that there's always been a group of people who felt none of this Torah Shabbat Pes stuff, it's all there in the Torah. Okay? Alright, so we see that the Torah has all these, but here, just to finish off the difference between casuistic and apodictic, is that casuistic law reacts to a situation. If you dig a pit, if you build a fire, right? Apodictic law would be something that doesn't appear in Sefer Mishpatim. Don't dig pits in the public square. Or don't light a fire in the wind. Why doesn't the Torah say it? Because you're allowed to dig a pit in the public square. You just have to be safe. You have to put up signs. You have to put up barriers. You're allowed to light a fire in the wind. Just make sure it doesn't spread. Following? Now, sometimes the Torah does give you things like that in an apodictic way, but it happens not to be in Mishpatim. It's in Kisesei, such as build a gate around your roof so that someone who climbs from roof to roof doesn't fall off. Get it? That's not apodictic. That's not casuistic. That's apodictic. Casuistic would be if someone is walking from roof to roof and he slips on your roof, this is what you should do. No, there's no such law like that. The Torah just says, build a fence around your roof so that no one falls. Following the difference between apodictic and casuistic now?
Yeah.
Thou shalt not kill. apodictic. It doesn't say, if you kill, this is what you should do. In the Code of Hammurabi, you have a chart about stealing and killing. A chart. Why? Because there are five or six different levels of society. Let's say one being the highest, royalty, five being the lowest, the slave. So if a five even looks cross-eyed at a one, he could be punished. Right? You know what I'm saying? Everyone is punished based on the chart. If a three steals from a four, or, you know, if you steal from someone lower, less of a punishment, if you steal from someone higher, steal someone significantly higher, right? So the Torah says, well, wafen, Torah echas yelochem v'lager hagor v'sochachem. I don't want any of this, that there's someone higher or someone lower. It's one straight Torah. It's easier to put out the law, right? Okay, so that's the difference between apodictic and casuistic. And then we just have wisdom literature. We're going to compare some of the ancient Near East to Sefer Mishlei. And then number six, just the three specific items we're going to be discussing. It's very interesting points. And the grade is based on the midterm, final, and there's one paper which you're going to love doing. I'm going to pick on things that you're going to enjoy preparing for. And that's the course. All right? Okay.
How long will the paper be? How many pages?
Instead of something, just take one topic and pursue it. These five, 7 pages, something light. Okay. All right. So I know you have